Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Fran Leeden, author of Broadway, A History of New York City in 13 Miles, published in April by Norton. Mr. Leeden is an associate professor at City College and worked with Narvel White and Elliot Walensky in publishing the AIA Guide to New York City, the fifth edition, which was published by Oxford University Press back in 2010. And he is from my hometown of Gainesville, Florida.
Whoa.
We could talk about that. Broadway is not just a street or an avenue or a boulevard. It is Broadway with a capital everything. It's the Great White Way, it's Times Square, it's Union Square, the Woolworth Building, the Flatiron, the Ansonia Hotel, apartment hotel. It's a street that defines a city. And what this author has done here is to encapsulate that street in its 13 miles into the history of a place that everyone in America and most people around the globe can identify with. And so through copious research and a map of each mile to keep you centered, the book transports you in time and place and kind of gives you an intimate picture of times forgotten and remembered, buildings that burnt down and were replaced, and buildings that weren't. But in any event, after you've read this book, you will have a new understanding of this great city, a city that in good portion defines America. And with that, welcome, Fran, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I can't believe you're from Gainesville.
Yeah,
I want to just talk about Gainesville now.
Well, so were you born and raised in Gainesville?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Gainesville. I lived there until 1991 when I moved north.
Yeah, you're much younger than me. I graduated the University of Florida in 74 and went to law school in 77. In fact, I was just back last week because my family, who has a company, a building company, we bought the property, the town of Tioga, the town center there, as you go towards Jonesville on Newbury
Road. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it really has changed in all this time, too. It's gotten much like what the city we're talking about, how the changes have occurred. So did you go to Gainesville High, or did you go to P.K. Young? Or
neither. I actually went to Oak Hall.
Okay.
Don't know if you've heard of it.
Sure. A lot of my friends.
On Tower Road.
Yeah. My friend Mark Gaber and his daughters went there, and So we're trying to sell some books here, so in any event.
Sorry.
So I know you've been asked this question scores of time, but why Broadway instead of some other great thoroughfare, like Fifth Avenue or like Park Avenue?
Well, I had thought about Park Avenue. I thought that would be really interesting, especially since it's kind of an extension of the Bowery, so you could work the Bowery into it. Park Avenue changes so drastically as soon as you get above 125th Street. And so culturally, it's really interesting. So actually, I kind of did a little work on Park Avenue, assuming that Broadway didn't make sense because so many histories had been written about it. I just made that assumption and was astonished to find out that that wasn't the case. And I thought, well, if nobody else has written a history of Broadway, then I guess I should. So that's why I picked Broadway. It just seemed like the obvious choice.
Yeah, I mean, the only other book that really describes Broadway in extensive style as yours is a photograph book, right? It's a book of photography.
Yeah, it's called On Broadway, which is by the great David Dunlap, who's a wonderful writer and photographer. But that came out in 1990, and it's out of print, and it's focusing on the architecture exclusively, and I wanted to write more of a social history of the street, not just focus on architecture, but write about everything that had happened there.
Well, you know, when talking about architecture, did your experience of writing the AIA guide with your mentors, because you really scoured the city, did that in any way influence or help the writing of this book?
It did, yeah, sure. It kind of, I wouldn't have done it had I not been involved with the AIA guide. I actually never met Elliot Walensky. He died in 1990. And so I just worked with Norval White, although Walensky's name is still on that on that edition. So I never met Walensky, but I worked with White and got to be very, really close to him, and it was really like going back to school. And I learned so much about the city, and it was, the AIA guide was only 18 months of work. It was really intense, but it was only 18 months of work.
Wow.
And so when I finally got done with that, I really kind of wanted to keep studying the city. And truthfully, I was, at that point, I was addicted to going around looking at buildings and photographing them, and I couldn't stop even if I wanted to at that point. So I kept writing about it and kept looking, and I wanted to do another book right away. In fact, Norville and I had tentative plans to do a book together, a second book about something about New York. And then he died right before the AIA guide came out. So I wanted to carry on and do another book anyway. And since I inherited Norville White's agent, Howard Morheim, Howard was really pushing me to do a second book right away too. So that was a big part of it.
But this book took a lot longer than 18 months, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I started it in the summer of 2010. And the way that it happened was, that was the hottest summer on record, 2010. And my wife and I had a baby in April of that year, our first child. And so we had a newborn that summer. And so when he was like 2 months old, we decided to leave for the summer. And we went up to Woodstock, where we stayed. I know this doesn't make sense. It'll make sense in a minute. We stayed in Woodstock in a little, it was marketed as a cabin. It was really a shed, this tiny little shed overlooking a babbling brook. And so every other day, my wife and I would trade off, and one of us would hike across the babbling brook through the woods and down a highway till we got to downtown Woodstock, and that was our kind of our break away from the baby. And so I started going to the Woodstock Library every other day. And as it happens, the Woodstock Library has an incredible section on New York City. And so I just started picking books off the shelf, really, just to pass the time. And I started reading, really for the first time, started reading the history of New York City, and then started thinking about Broadway. So that's kind of, that's the long-winded answer. But
wow.
That was in 2010, and then I got so deeply into the history that it took years and years to finish.
Yeah, it's almost exactly 8 years since the birth of your son.
And he says, now he's 8 years old, and he says, he's super excited that I finally finished, because this book has been with him his entire life.
That's true.
So it's kind of crazy it took that long, but the way things go.
What prompted you to feel that, you know, most New Yorkers or visitors to New York pretty much focus on miles 1 through mile 6. And
right.
And then when you go beyond mile 6, the avenue, the street, whatever you want to call it, changes in a dramatic way. And that was kind of news to me, because I've never walked it completely, which I will do the next time I go up there. But it really does change, like when you talk about Manhattanville, which you don't love as much as the rest of Broadway.
No, and Manhattanville was really difficult to write about. You know, that part of it is not the happy section of the book. And I had a hard time writing that section. And in fact, I skipped it. I went ahead and I think I did, that's mile 9. I think I went ahead to mile 10 and 11 and worked on those a little bit. And I mean, Manhattanville is a valley, and Broadway suddenly dips down into this valley underneath the subway, and it's a place where they built a bunch of housing projects in the 1950s, and it's always changing, but it's really pretty grim compared to the rest of the street. So that was really hard to write about.
One of the more interesting, and we talked about this briefly before we started, was interesting and puzzling, and it always was puzzling to me, is the jog that Broadway takes at 10th. and then never really meanders back from. And explain briefly, because it's fascinating, how that occurred and why it occurred.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I remember the first time that I saw it, and it's because it's right at the front steps of Grace Church, which is a beautiful Gothic Revival church. It was built in the 1840s. I assumed that Broadway had swerved around the church, but when I first saw it years ago. And I've kind of collected all these different stories that trying to explain why it's there, and they're really entertaining. One of them involves drunk surveyors who couldn't survey a straight line. A lot of them are there. There's variations on a Dutch farmer who ended up writing about Henry Brevoort, who supposedly stopped Broadway from going through his land. There's a million different variations of this myth. But the reason I found out that it jogs at that point is because in the late 18th century, I think it was in the 70s, the city wanted to extend Broadway north, and so it would hook up with Fifth Avenue. But they would have to go through land and take land in order to do that, and the land they were trying to go through belonged to two or three of the city's most prominent and wealthy merchants. One was a merchant, one was a judge. And they basically said flat out, you can't have our land. Broadway cannot go through our land. So they had no alternative if they were going to continue Broadway, but to angle it at that point and plow through someone else's land. So that wasn't easy either, and that led to years of lawsuits. But eventually they did that, and it also then lined up with the Bloomingdale Road, which was a little further north and was a colonial highway. And at 23rd Street, then Broadway picks up the path of the Bloomingdale Road, which was angled in the first place, I guess just because it was following the kind of high ground of Manhattan up the west side of the island. So that's why it happens. And then things developed and the city developed, and then it was too late to change it. So it was kind of a temporary solution to do that. And then there it is.
Yeah. One of the fascinating things about the book, and I guess the two favorite things about the book to me, are the people behind Broadway and also the buildings. And like for one of the examples, and there's tons of them, including Grace Church and the Usonia, but like my third favorite building behind the Chrysler Building and the Sherry Netherland is the Flatiron Building. Tell a little bit about its history, because it's fascinating as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Flatiron is probably my favorite building on Broadway, if not my favorite building, period. And I'm definitely not alone in thinking that. Every once in a while they do a poll of New Yorkers, and the Flatiron Building always comes out number one in polls of favorite buildings. I mean, it's just a phenomenal building. And I devote a whole chapter to it. It's just fascinating. And it was not the tallest building ever built. And in fact, it wasn't the tallest building in the city even at the time it was completed in 1902. But it was unique because its triangular shape came from the crashing together of Fifth Avenue and Broadway. And that was the result. And then in order to maximize square footage, they just extruded that triangle up 20 stories. And even though it was a steel building, the architects clad it with terracotta and brick and limestone to make it look like a neoclassical building. So that it's weird because of that, because you don't expect a neoclassical building made out of stone to be that thin. And I think that's what gives it its weird, peculiar character. And when it was finished, a lot of people the press really hated it. They really criticized it, and they called it the freak. And they were convinced that in the first storm it was going to blow over because it was so thin. But, of course, it's made out of steel, and it's strong as hell, so that was never really a danger. And then immediately when it was finished, people started noticing that it looked like a ship. And there's a famous photograph by Alfred Stieglitz, where he describes it as an ocean liner plowing its way north in the city. So it's, there's something about it that's really kinetic and dynamic, and it's still as surprising as it ever was, you know, over 100 years later.
The other funny story was the fact that because of the way it's built and where it's located, the winds swirl about it, and guys used to go down to catch the sight of a woman's ankle as her dress swirled up about her. That was, I never knew that.
That was a pretty big deal for years. The thing that I never adequately figured out is that I take them at their word. I mean, I've seen images of this, and I've read newspaper articles saying that it was like a hurricane around the base of that building when it was first built. And I staked out the Flatiron Building, and I just sat there for hours. I went there on a lot of different days in different conditions, and I saw no evidence of peculiar winds there at all now.
Maybe because it's such a canyon now, taller buildings, I guess, around.
Well, that's what a lot of people told me they thought it was, and including some structural engineers, that the buildings around it have changed. But I looked at old photographs and maps, and actually the buildings right around it aren't really that different. They're pretty much the same buildings that were there when it was built. So I don't know why the wind is not an issue now. Or maybe it is, and I just happen to not be there on the right day. I don't know. But you don't ever hear about that now, so I don't think it is an issue.
What always fascinated me, and the reason I've never been inside of it, is I always wondered what it would be like at the prow of this ship.
Those
the offices, what kind of offices at the very end where the windows are around it? I mean, is it like 1 foot at one end and then it goes out to 10 or 15 feet? Have you been in it?
I have been, and it's really cool. The one office I was in was an office of Bloomsbury Publishing.
Huh.
And they were interested in maybe publishing this book, so I met with them. And I got to go in one of those offices, and it was basically just a desk. The desk was pushed up against the prow of the building, and it was just wide enough for a desk that you could have a desk there and walk around and sit there. But it was, I mean, it's like being in the crow's nest of a building or something. Of a ship. It was the coolest space I've just about ever seen.
Yeah, and the Ansonia has a little bit of that too, doesn't it? It has a little bit of the triangular too, right?
Well, it does, because it's a square, but it's cut with these quartz that slice the building, and then there's all these turrets. So there are all these round rooms. So it does have that feeling that the Flatiron does. And I was really fortunate that I latched onto Bernie Gelb at Ansonia Real Estate, and he was such a nice man, and he let me follow him while he was inspecting vacant apartments. So I got to walk through these amazing spaces in the Ansonia, and it does have that same quality. Like, there's these really strange round rooms and oval rooms and things like that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I had this woman now who worked in my bookstore, and when she got a job in publishing, she ended up working in the Woolworth Building. So I went in there with her and I said, God, you are so lucky to work in this building. And she had never really looked up. And she says, what do you mean? I said, this building it's amazing. And mm-hmm. I was overwhelmed by it and still am. And you talk about it too.
The Woolworth?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think I mention it in relationship to other skyscrapers. But unfortunately, I had written an entire chapter about the Woolworth that took me months to write. And it had a really catchy title, too, which was Cosmopolis. And I had to cut it out because I had other chapters, too, in that first mile. And the first mile was getting too long relative to the rest of the book.
Right. I can understand.
And I figured I already had chapters about the Flatiron. There's a whole, most of a chapter about the Times, New York Times building in Times Square. So I had kind of skyscrapers covered, and it was kind of a late decision, but I took out the chapter on the Woolworth, much to my regret.
Yeah, it is a great building. Well, you can write an article about it. I mean, It really is fascinating.
Yeah, that's true. I have a lot of chapters that didn't make it into the final book. It's almost like I could, I don't know, do like an outtakes book or something. Or
yeah, I read in one of your interviews about how you kind of, when you walk up Broadway now, you kind of feel like you missed some things that you'd like to put back in the book. And that'll probably be...
Just about every day I see something that I wish I'd put in. Just today I saw this image I had never seen before from, I don't know, 1910 or something. It was a photo montage of one of the Cunard liners, ocean liners, as if it was sailing up Broadway past the Woolworth Building. It was the coolest image. And I talk in the book about how for hundreds of years people have been comparing Broadway to a river. And there it was, you know, an ocean liner superimposed on the street. It was the coolest image, and it should have been in the book. But I didn't, you know, just found it today. So, yeah, every single day I find out something else about Broadway, and oh well.
Well, you know, in researching and thinking about Broadway, because I do love it too, when I was reading about Grace Church, and you talk about Grace Church, I realized it was built in, I guess, 1899, but it wasn't put on the National Registry of Historic Places until 1980. And I wondered about
that. Wait, Grace Church at Broadway and 10th Street?
What's the church between Broadway and 73rd, between 73rd and 74th?
You know what? I'm so sorry. Someone's ringing my damn doorbell.
That's okay. I can cut it out.
Sorry.
Okay.
Can I answer it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, sorry. Hold on. FedEx. I'm sorry about that.
That's all right. We'll just I can just cut it out, and actually let's just start anew. And I won't mention the church. So how come it takes so long to get these beautiful buildings that you talk about on the National Registry of Historic Places? At least for some of them.
Sorry, which building are you talking about?
Well, I've looked at a couple of them, and it just seems like, you know, the ones that were built in the late 1800s, I noticed that, you know, they aren't on the registry. Maybe I'm mistaken, but it seems like they aren't on the registry until, like, you know, 40 years ago, 30 or 40 years ago.
Hmm. I think it, in some cases, I think because if they're designated as New York City landmarks, I'm just speculating here, but
okay,
if they're landmarks... as far as New York City is concerned, then perhaps they're considered protected enough that that designation kind of doesn't come till later.
Okay.
But that's just conjecture. I'm not really sure.
Talk a little bit about the questions that other people might be interested in. I know you've been asked and answered these, but how did Broadway become the home of the theater district? Because that's where most people go, and I'm sure they wonder.
Well, it was, there was a theater on Broadway really early on, like early 18th century, I think, like 1730s maybe, there was a theater on Broadway. But it wasn't really until the early 19th century where there were a pretty sizable collection of theaters in the city. For years, there were just one or two theaters, plus circuses and things like that. So the first true theater district started around City Hall, and they were on Broadway, but also on the Bowery, which splits off at City Hall, and on Chambers Street as well. So there was a collection of theaters there, and then they started, as the city grew to the north and as commercial buildings started to take over the lower part of the city, they, because of rising rents and land values, they forced the theaters to go north along with a lot of other things too. So the theaters started to creep up the Bowery and creep up Broadway, and they were on both streets. So the theater district was on both Broadway and the Bowery. And they kind of had their own identities, but the Bowery theaters were, generally speaking, just as legitimate as the Broadway theaters. And then they kind of came together then in the 1860s, 1870s, 80s around Union Square. So that's where the Bowery and Broadway come back together. So that was this thriving theater scene called the Rialto. And then they just continued. But then the Bowery is basically done. So Broadway continued to the north, and the theaters continued to expand up, along with hotels and restaurants and offices. All of them kind of continued to expand. And they went all the way up to into the West Side, into the 60s. And somehow, I think it's because of the subway and the development of Times Square that most of the theaters started developing around there in the early 20th century and started spreading to side streets as well. And that kind of coalesced as the theater district that's still intact today for the most part.
Yeah, and speaking about the theater district, another question is that some people may not understand what happened is, where did Broadway get its name, the Great White Way, and talk about electricity and, you know, the battle between
the scenes? I'm not exactly sure where that particular name came from, although there was a novel published in, I think, 1901 called The Great White Way that had nothing to do with Broadway. It was a Arctic exploration novel by Albert Bigelow Paine. But right after that, people started calling it the Great White Way. So, or the Gay White Way. They would also call it the Gay White Way, kind of interchangeably. It all comes from the electricity. And the electricity, the electric lighting had started to come into Broadway in the 1880s. And then all of the theater marquees were lit with Edison's incandescent bulbs. And so it was the arrival of the electric light that really turned it into the Great White Way. And it originally, that stretch of the street was much longer than we realized. It originally started at Madison Square at 23rd Street and went all the way up past Columbus Circle.
Huh. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's much longer than we... It wasn't just around Times Square at that point.
Well, yeah, when talking about Times Square and moving on to some of the people that you discuss... Talk a little bit about, because his songs kind of memorialized it, about George M. Cohan and how he developed not only his empire, but, you know, his songwriting and all that.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to get him into the book. Well, I felt like I had to. I mean, he's a book about Broadway that doesn't include Cohan would be pretty worthless, right?
Yeah.
And his statue is in the middle of Times Square. So I knew that I had to include him, and I actually originally had a lot more about him. I kind of cut it down a little bit, but I got really into Cohan. I read his autobiography. I read a couple of biographies that others have written about him, and I've always loved his music ever since I was a kid, and I saw the James Cagney biopic about him. You know, I used to love that movie. I watched it a couple of years ago when I was writing this book, and it was kind of like, it's not that great of a movie. But when I was a kid, for some reason, it really touched a nerve. I don't know why.
Me too. It was just the way it was the way he sang and the way he danced.
Did you see that movie?
Yeah, sure.
I can't remember. Oh, Yankee Doodle Dandy, it's called.
Yep.
I don't know why I found it so compelling when I was a kid. I mean, Cagney is amazing.
Yeah.
The dancing is amazing.
I think
there's this great scene where he tap dances down a staircase.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, and the thing is, I thought when I was a little kid, I thought he was George M. Cohan.
Me too.
I got it all confused, and I thought that for years because he seemed like
I did too because he really just kind of melted into that role, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
And it actually took me a while to kind of separate Cagney from Cohan and realize that Cohan was his own person. And now I have the real Cohan firmly fixed in my mind, but he was such a character. I mean, just such a character, and he was so compelling. His whole trajectory, it was really like rags to riches, and it was really like the American story, Cohan. I mean, and he talks about in his autobiography about hanging around Union Square trying to get peddling his songs to music publishers. And his first big break was with Whitmark and Sons. And I was really struck by how similar his whole career trajectory was to Bob Dylan's, which you never would put them together.
No.
But Dylan also, he was peddling his songs to Whitmark too. And, 75 years later, and hanging around in some of the same spots. Like, Bob Dylan really was kind of like a Broadway songwriter, just like Cohan.
Yeah, that one picture of him.
And both of them were kind of like not the biggest guys, like kind of short and wiry. And both of them had their kind of unique style that people had to kind of learn to appreciate. And both of them could do a lot of different things, you know. I kind of started to think about Cohan more like an early version of Bob Dylan.
And it was nice. It's nice that you put, there's so many great photographs in there. And I don't know how long it took you to compile them and to get releases if you had to, but it really does flesh out the book because you get to see these people. And you might have had, I did have an image of George M. Cohan. And then when I looked at the picture, it wasn't at all what I thought it would be.
Well, that image, it's funny you mentioned that because the image that I put in the book of Cohan is not the typical image. The more typical ones are of him dancing or of him kind of posing in a role or just like a headshot, like a very posed headshot. And I liked that one because he's coming out of a building and he's looking down and it's kind of this offhand moment. It's even kind of blurry a little bit, but I felt like that kind of, you kind of saw his personality somehow because he's not posing. Even though he's looking down, you can't see his eyes. I just love that image. He looks so kind of confident, and he was definitely on top of the world at that point. I mean, he was the guy that invented Broadway. When people think of Broadway, it's largely because of Cohan, because he wrote these songs about Broadway, and he wrote all of these plays about Broadway. The Man Who Owns Broadway, Broadway Jones, blah, blah, blah. He wrote like a half a dozen plays with Broadway in the title. And he wrote all these songs and they went all over the country as sheet music. And at this point, people still had pianos and they were playing his songs in their living rooms. And he was the one who really kind of packaged Broadway as this kind of American street, this theatrical street. He was the one who kind of got the rest of the world to understand Broadway that way.
It's funny, lots of times, especially in our times today politically, it seems as if the times make the man. And in your book, there are lots of times where the men or women, but mostly men, made the times. And like you were just saying about George M. Cohan, part of what we know of Broadway is because of his songs and the fact that he existed and helped to make it what it was. Which was really good because I didn't realize that before,
it is mostly men, isn't it?
It is. That's
there's some pretty strong female characters in the book too, but
you talk about them in terms of the brothel houses. they come out in there.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's true. But I mean, there are some other pretty strong women characters in the book, but I was struck again by how history is really written by men. I mean, especially when you're reading about the 19th century and 18th century, there's just not a lot of women who appear in the sources. I found some diaries that were written by women, and that was interesting, but they just kind of are not in the official record of that period.
One of the things that you said in I think it was an interview, and I've noticed this too as well, that Broadway seems different if you look at it in different times of the day. Like you said, at sunrise, you can almost imagine it like it was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And then midday it's different, and at sunset it's different. So you really, I mean, you're the expert. Do you feel that way? Do you see the difference in different times of the day or different light?
Yeah, I mean, that's true of every street in the city to a certain extent.
Yeah.
but I think it's especially true on Broadway because, and this is the reason that Broadway became so important in the first place, is that until the West Side, everything below 59th Street, Broadway is pretty much in the middle of the island. And even today, it kind of is this catch basin for traffic and people, and this intersection of people coming from the East Side and the West Side and going up and down it. And it kind of, it swells with people, and then there's kind of times where there's kind of a lull. And that happens everywhere in the city, but I think it's especially exaggerated on Broadway.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's, you know, Broadway is so famous that I was surprised to be there when no one else was there. That was really weird to me. That I guess I thought in my mind that because of the whole mythology of the Great White Way, I thought right. that the lights are always on and people are always there and, you know, there's always traffic and something happening. And I walked up from Battery. That time I walked about half of it up to the West Side, starting at 6 in the morning on a summer morning, and there was no one around. I mean, there was no one around. I walked up, you know, past City Hall, nobody, walked all the way through Soho, didn't see a soul in Soho, and got all the way to Union Square before I started seeing anybody, and they were kind of like people, and it was a weekday, too. That's the thing. It's really interesting when Broadway is completely deserted. It's a whole different street.
Yeah, I know. It's like, you know, it's like how people say New York City is a great place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. But the thing about New York that's really good is that it's a very walkable city, like Boston.
Yep.
And you wouldn't think it, or a lot of people who are from different states do not think it's a walkable city. They go to, mm-hmm. you know, TGI Fridays and Times Square, and they think that's New York. But
well, I took that for granted, honestly. I took that totally for granted until a few years ago we went to Nashville and spent a week in Nashville.
Yeah.
Where you literally cannot cross the street because they haven't provided a way for a pedestrian to cross the street. Literally. Like, you can't get from... We were staying in a hotel... And there was a Starbucks on the other side. I just wanted to get some coffee in the morning. And I couldn't cross the street because they have those intersections where they have the continuous turning lanes on all four sides. So there's literally no way you can get across the street. And I've been to other places where, you know, you have to take your life in your hands and walk along a highway shoulder to walk anywhere. And I've come to a new appreciation for New York as a walkable city. It really is.
Yeah, the worst is L.A., where, well, like in New York, 94-96% of it is paved. But in L.A.,
yeah.
if you don't have a car, I mean, and if you're walking, you probably are going to get stopped by a cop because no one walks.
That's right. That's right. People in Nashville, people were looking at me like I was a weirdo. Like, what is this guy doing? He's going to ask me for money or something. Yeah.
yeah. The other thing about Broadway is, you know, when it is walked and it is crowded, just like Fifth Avenue, the people who walk it, true New Yorkers, are as comfortable there as they would be anywhere else. And the people from out of town who come there at, say, Christmas time or something like that, it's just, you know, they're not coming back again.
Yeah, there's a way of walking in New York that I think is a learned thing. And I think I can do it at this point.
Yeah, you should be able to.
But I remember when I first moved here, I was running into people all the time. There's something about, you learn like this Broadway weave or something. You learn how to negotiate crowds with people. And if you walk up Broadway and you hit Times Square, it's all full of tourists. And they have no idea how to do that. And so
they don't know they can cross a cross street. They don't know that they can cross a cross street. So
yeah.
Yeah. So, I guess you love the city, right?
No, you know, like everybody, it's love-hate. It's definitely love-hate. I think that, you know, I'm from Gainesville, and that's really where my heart is, and I think about it every day.
Really?
And that's my you know, ideal size of city with lots of trees and
I would have given up
on New York had I not done the AIA guide in this book. I think I would have given up on it. What this allowed me to do was to focus on places and buildings and what was there before, and it got me interested in the city beyond just kind of the grind of the daily routine, which was really wearing me down. And I still really don't like that about New York. I mean, this morning it was raining and I had to take my two little kids to school on the city bus because it was raining so hard. And we got on the bus and, you know, just people are so rude. You know, they were yelling at my kids for having their backpacks on and being in the way. And sometimes, you know, something like that happens. I just feel like I cannot stand New York another day.
That's so funny to hear that.
So it's definitely, it's love, hate.
It's really funny. I was reading this article today, and who knew? But The Simpsons, maybe you read it, they have an episode in which they denigrate Gainesville. They call it Dullsville, and Homer...
I don't know.
Yeah, Homer...
I never knew that.
No, it just happened. There was this episode, and Homer wins a vacation to Gainesville, and he calls it Dullsville, and tries to get to go somewhere else. And so then there was a response from the mayor of Gainesville, whose name I forgot, and says, you know, at least we're noticed on The Simpsons. We must be something. But
that's great.
Who would have thought?
I didn't know that.
No, it just happened. I just happened to look at my Google News feed, and there it was.
But
in any event, I really enjoy talking to you about this today. As I said, I own an independent bookstore, and the book's on the front table, and it has a great cover. And
you have a bookstore?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and you probably used to go to the Book Gallery West in Gainesville. I used to hang out there.
Oh my God, the Book Gallery. When I first started going to the Book Gallery, it was downtown. It was on University Avenue right by Main Street.
Yeah, I remember it.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, sure.
And
my bookstore has a fountain in it just because the Book Gallery West has a fountain in it, and I always wanted water in my bookstore. So, yeah, if you ever get in Philadelphia, come by.
Oh, I would love to. I love bookstores. What's the name of your store?
Wellington Square Bookshop.
Oh, I'm definitely going to come by.
Oh, that's great.
Wellington Square.
Yep.
We had this tragedy last year. Our bookstore right on our street, Court Street in Brooklyn, closed. Book Court closed after 30 years, and it was just such a blow. I mean, it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah, I know.
And I remember in Gainesville, Mike's Bookstore. Do you remember Mike's?
Sure. I remember all these places.
So you went to Mike's? I mean, that was like my home, basically. I practically grew up at Mike's.
Yeah, and I would find first editions, and that's how I first started collecting books, actually.
No kidding.
Yeah. I was up here in Philadelphia before, but I moved to Gainesville in 72. January 5th, 1972, and I lived there for 29 years, 5 months, and 10 days. For some reason, I'm like an idiot savant, and I can remember dates like that perfectly. But
I remember 1972 so well.
How come?
I started first grade. I was 6 years old, and the Eagles' first record came out in 1972, and my brother was in the Eagles.
Oh, okay.
So that was a...
Oh, Bernie?
1972 is just like a... I remember that.
Your brother was Bernie?
Bernie, yeah.
Holy mackerel. And it's so funny because Judge Tench, I practiced law there, so Judge Tench was my judge, and his son is Benmont Tench, the keyboardist for Tom Petty. And, you know, Tom Petty went to Gainesville High also. And
my brother Tom was best friends with Tom Petty and played in a band called Mudcrutch with him. Petty lived on the other side of the park from us, from Northeast Park.
Mudcrutch got back together, and I was just listening to a song by Mudcrutch today, and it wasn't so bad. It was pretty good. They're like old geezers. Yeah, Tom Petty dying was was a big blow to me. Yeah, because I was just listening to "Running Down in the Dream," which was 1989 April, and Gainesville was a really great town. I remember Judge Tench married my ex-wife and I, and I remember I changed my clothes in Benmont Tench's bedroom, and I got to look through all his record albums, and I was so excited because he liked all the same stuff I liked.
Anyway,
made me feel so cool.
Yeah, Benmont is great. He's a really, really terrific guy and a great musician. And I met Judge Tench once, just once, and it was like, I remember shaking his hand. It was like, at that point, I'd never met anybody like that before. I felt like I was meeting a senator or something, you know. He had this real kind of like presence.
Yes, he did.
About him. That was really cool.
Yeah, he was a cool guy. And then I practiced with Jerry Felder, and his brother was Don Felder,
who
was a guitarist for the Eagles as well. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So you practiced law in Gainesville?
Yeah, for many, many years.
So my late parents' lawyer was the great old firm of Scruggs Carmichael.
Sigsbee Scruggs.
Sigsbee Scruggs was my dad and mom's lawyer.
Wow.
And he was like an amazing old Southern character, you know, right? Like out of a novel.
He represented Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings in
a copyright
case over the Yearling.
Yeah.
Okay, we got to stop talking about this.
It's fascinating. So much in common. That's
well, yeah, incredible. I mean, yeah. So seriously, if you come down and you just look at our website, Wellington Square Bookshop, I'll send it off to you. Just stop in anytime. Give me a heads up, and we'll go have a drink and reminisce.
Oh, I'd love to.
Okay. Well, thanks again for coming on. And
thanks.
I love your book, and it'll be definitely after this broadcast. Hopefully, it'll be flying out the window, flying out the doors.
Oh, that would be great.
Okay. So thanks again.
Tell me your name again.
Sam Hankin. Hankin.
Okay. Okay. Great.
Okay. Talk to you later then.
Okay. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Bye bye. Well, I didn't mean to get off on that tangent, but we have so much in common. I mean, we have so many memories that we share. I can't believe he's from Gainesville, and his brother was in, Bernie Ledden was a guitarist for the Eagles, and I knew Don Felder, who was a guitarist for the Eagles, and Ben Montench, who was a great keyboardist for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. It has nothing to do with his book on Broadway. But, I hope he comes down. I hope I meet him. He seemed like a really nice guy. So anyway, as I always say, Rebecca, my producer, picks great authors. We have a whole bunch of them coming up. Too long to list. We're well into summer. So for a complete schedule, you can always visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com. Go to the radio station's website, which is just wche1520.com. Or you can download our podcasts at iTunes or at Podomatic. And, that was a blast. I'm really glad I met him over the phone. So thanks for joining us. And we hope to have you back here next week for hopefully another great interview with an up-and-coming or established great author. So thanks again for being here with us on The Avid Reader.